the first of five sessions on the theme body politics. And first I have to explain the theme. We have the intellectual habit of separating different realms that we care about in order to look at one of them at a time. If you're describing the life of a group, you describe it by showing a picture or telling a story of how it behaves. But we consider as a separate realm the study of ethics, which means interpreting our behavior and our decisions in the light of rules or values that are given to us by some authority. And yet another chapter is sacraments, which is a few different kinds of behavior that are singled out from the rest to have a special, specifically theological meaning. Yet something else is what we call social ethics when we look at the institutional shape of the world around us and try to make value judgments about strategies and policies. And within that realm, something still a little farther away and a little more autonomous is politics. That is when the institutions that are involved are like the state. And we have another set of special problems in knowing what we can say about them. In this study process, I'll be looking at themes which reach across that compartmentalization. I won't be thinking in every hour with exactly the same balance in each of those compartments, but it's true of all of our five topics that they spill across the categories, and intentionally so. It will be the case of all of the five areas we'll look at from now to Saturday that they describe social practices, that is, things that people do together. The early Christians did them together in the conviction that doing that way was what God wanted. And more than that, in fact, that when they did those things that way, God was doing those things that way through them. Two of these, actually, I have learned so little about that the same topic is on a tape that's for sale in the bookstore from 10 years ago. So that's to prove that people after 50 can be counted on to repeat themselves. But I think I'll be describing in a different way. And the theme for this time, both titles were picked up by Ingrid or Jody in making the program. One is functional, discerning and forgiving, and the other is the technical New Testament phrase, binding and loosing. And first I'll begin by looking at the particular New Testament passage that is the fullest on the subject, not looking at it deeply, but enough to pull from it the things that carry across into the other categories that I was talking about. Does anybody besides our official Bible teacher for the week know from what passage the phrase bind and loose comes?
Matthew 18 and 16
are somewhat parallel. This is 18. 16 is talking about Peter as the foundation, and also there's a statement about the authority of the disciples. The one we're looking at is in chapter 18. Chapter 18 is all about forgiveness. It has parables about forgiveness and epigrams about forgiveness, conversation with the disciple about how often to forgive. But the core that we'll be looking at now is chapter 18, verses 15 and following. It breaks down clearly into two subsets or texts, in that you being spoken to is in the singular in the first three verses, in the plural in the other three, but it hangs together in the present reading nevertheless. If your brother sins, go reprove him. between you and him alone. Obviously, I'll leave it in the masculine for now because of the older translations, but there is never any gender focus to this. We could say sister all the way, it would be the same. Although generally, we incline more to generalize the gender of good passages than the bad ones. So since it's sinning, we'll let it be him. Notice there aren't many people that want to feminize Satan either. If he listens, you have won your brother. If he does not listen, take with you one or two more, so that, quoting from Deuteronomy, by the mouth of two or three witnesses every matter be established. If he will not listen to them, tell the church. If he will not listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Truly I say to you, what you bind on earth shall stands bound in heaven. What you loose on earth stands loosed in heaven. Stands is the rendering here of the future perfect, that which shall be fixed. Again, if two of you agree on earth concerning any matter for which they ask, it shall be done for them by my Father, for where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am in their midst. This describes a procedure. Obviously, as we have it in Matthew's text, it's Jesus himself who tells his disciples to do it. And Matthew would hardly have reported it a couple generations later, this simply and this fully, if it had been a practice that had never been carried out, or that the Christians were ashamed of, or had forgotten. So it is probably something that would have been seen as doable in the Church of Matthew. The procedure is non-clerical. It's not to be done by the priest or the elders of the synagogue. You do it, and singular, thou, the individual who knows of the offense, is to do it. That means it's the responsibility of every member of the body. No one is not responsible to approach the offending brother or sister with a view to reconciliation. That's the second point. It's with a view to reconciliation, to winning the person. It's not punitive. It's not pedagogical in the sense that we got to teach everybody a lesson so that everybody else sees that you don't get away with doing this. The concern is to win the person who has jeopardized his or her relationship to the community by that offending act. The offense is not specified, and that's interesting. There's no basis for a distinction between big sins and little sins, or between sins that are on the book as forbidden and other offenses that you just know are wrong because looking at the setting you know they're wrong. There isn't a difference that later Catholicism, much later, makes between venial and mortal sins. No, it's just any offense jeopardizes the unity of the community, and you who know about it are responsible to do something about it. There are five letters in the original Greek of some versions that make a big difference in the meaning. It's in the older translations. If your brother sins against you. That's just two tiny words in Greek. Ace, sith. They're not in the oldest manuscripts. The difference they make is significant because if they belong in the text, then the only sin concerning which it's my business to go to my brother about is my brother's sin against me. Then the problem is mine. And if I'm a big enough person, or I'm hard-skinned, I don't really need to go to my brother, so the thing doesn't need to happen. And that's the way we often tend to take it. So I'm off the hook, it's not my problem. A, it's not my problem if I'm such a big person that I can bear the sin without being hurt and without holding it against him. And secondly, it's not my business if it's against somebody else. Then they have to decide whether they want to go to him. Those verses probably don't belong. They're clearly absent in the parallel passage in Luke 17. And the parallel passage in Leviticus from which Jesus is probably quoting. There it's just, if your brother offends, go to him. The theological reason I'm glad they're not in the best texts is that It moves the focus from the person offended to the person offended, from the person in need of being forgiven. And that's the offender. This is a passage, and the whole chapter is about the purpose of God that the offender be restored. And this is the procedure for doing it. The intention, as I said, is restorative, not punitive. And the worst possible outcome is not exile or the death penalty, but non-membership. That is, treat this person as an outsider. And we know how Jesus treated outsiders. He dealt with him in such a way that some of his close associates thought he was too free, and many of his critics claimed that.
But maybe they did that a lot in the first century church, or they didn't, I don't know, but do they ever do it in this century? Two or three people in the church council go to reprimand or confront a parishioner? And how do you do that? Do you just say, well, it worked then, it doesn't work now? Or do you take the Bible literally and say, why don't we do it now? And
You're pushing me to get relevant too soon.
Yes, it does happen today. It's happening in our church right now.
I was going to say there's no reason it can't, and certainly there are times that I know where it has, but it isn't standard institutional practice, and that's partly the reason we have to think about this across the categories, because we don't think of this as relating to modern problem solving or the structures of a modern parish or something else. There's nothing keeping it from happening in the structures. There's nothing in the Augsburg Confession that says you shouldn't do it. Any individual can do it any time because it's precisely a personal function unrelated to the structure of the church as parish. The second step asks then for a couple other people to go along, and there it would be normal human wisdom that they be people of leadership quality or responsibility, but not necessarily. It might be that they should be people close to that person. It isn't until it becomes the third phase of being publicly the knowledge of the whole local gathered church that then obviously if that church has official structures that they will have to participate in it. Now there are two places we see this in the writings of Paul, to skip over rapidly, in Galatians chapter 6. If someone is overtaken in a fault, you who think you're spiritual, restore in the spirit of meekness, knowing that you are also tempted. He calls that the law of Christ, which is a term we'll come back to. The other place is in 2 Corinthians, where there is it's 1 Corinthians chapter 6, where there is the account of people in Corinth who have been taking each other to court, in the civil courts. And Paul says three different things, made three different arguments on top of each other. One, the last one, the final one, why wouldn't you just rather be defrauded? It isn't worth it. Bear the cross. The first one was, don't you realize that the pagan courts have no standing in the Christian community because we're going to be their judges in the end time rather than their being our judges. So it's out of order that you should go to the pagans to be your judges. But the one in between is, aren't there a couple people among you who could mediate? Well, he's talking about the same process. So it was there in Corinth. It was a feasible, it was a doable thing in the synagogues and in the Christian synagogues of the first century. Now I leap a long ways, but to one of the other places that we go to get our orientation in Western Protestantism. In 1526, Martin Luther published what was called the German Mass and Order of Service. This was the first time that there was now for everybody one right way to do the Mass celebration. We still use the word Mass at that time, in the German language, with all of the scripture readings and the hymnody translated in a pattern that was ready for print. In the preface to this liturgy, he says, I don't want this to take over. I want there to be other kinds of liturgy as well. There are three kinds of divine service. The first is the one in Latin, which we published earlier under the title Formula Missae, there was a Lutheranized Mass in Latin for the University Church at Wittenberg, which was already published, where the theology was changed to represent Lutheran theology of the time instead of the Catholic tradition, but it was still in Latin. And I want that. I want that to keep going on whenever we want to. I don't want to discontinue the service in the Latin language because the young are my chief concern. Isn't that interesting? For the sake of the young people, we want to keep the Latin. That isn't something that's going to happen in your church anyway. But the point was, this was a university church. It was, and Latin was the cultured language of anybody over 12 who went to school. It was the normal language in which to have a worship, and the fact that they had it in Latin meant that people from Italy and Romania and Holland and England and Poland could all be there in this Latin Protestant service, and Luther wanted to keep that. Well, that's one question. The second is this text, which I'm now giving you, he says, which should be arranged for the sake of the unlearned lay folk and with which we are now concerned. These two orders of service must be used publicly in the churches for all the people, among whom are many who do not believe and are not yet Christians. So he sees both of the two fixed forms that he publishes as being for a mixed multitude of not very Christian people, not very educated, not very committed, not very well prepared to make a Christian commitment, and for them we do this service. Most of them stand around and gape, hoping to see something new, just as if we were holding a service among the Turks or the heathen in a public square or out in the field. That is not yet a well-ordered and organized congregation in which Christians could be ruled according to the gospel. On the contrary, the gospel must be publicly preached to such people to move them to believe and become Christians. He maybe never knew that the normal German, normal Lutheran liturgy was meant for pagans in a field. The third kind of service should be a truly evangelical order and should not be held in a public place for all sorts of people. But those who want to be Christians in earnest and who profess the gospel with hand and mouth should sign their names, that's what he means with hand, and meet alone in a house somewhere to pray, to read, to baptize, to receive the sacrament, and to do other Christian works. So he wanted a house church of committed adults who would sign their names on a membership list and make commitments. According to this order, those who do not lead Christian lives could be known, reproved, corrected, cast out, or excommunicated according to the rule of Christ, Matthew 18. So if I had a truly evangelical church, it would be a church of adults committed to a voluntary order, not meeting in a highly public place, not presupposing that the listeners don't know the gospel, and they would practice Matthew 18, and he calls it the rule of Christ. Then he goes on and describes other things about it. Here one could also solicit benevolent gifts to be willingly given and distributed to the poor, according to Paul's example. Here would be no need of much and elaborate singing. Here one could set up a brief and neat order for baptism and the sacrament and center everything on the word, prayer, and love. In short, if one had the kind of people and persons who wanted to be Christians in earnest, the rules and regulations would soon be ready. But as yet, I neither can nor desire to begin such a congregation or assembly or to make rules for it, for I have not yet the people or persons for it, nor do I see many who want it. And if 2 centuries later, the Pietist movement came along in German Europe, Lutheran German Europe, and said, we're now doing what Luther was talking about. He never had the people, we do. We're going to have weeknight prayer services, we're going to have house churches and Bible study sessions, and that's what Luther wanted, and we should be authorized to have baptism and communion in that setting because that's what Luther really wanted, but he couldn't do it because he didn't have the people. Well, that's an early part of the debate about the form of the church, but the striking thing is that Luther uses the technical term rule of Christ, probably borrowed from Paul's usage in Galatians 6, to define specifically Matthew 18, which he cites. If that were the only passage, it wouldn't prove much. But Martin Bucer, who was doing something similar in Strasbourg, but was not a pupil of Luther's, was closer to Zwingli, and was the spiritual teacher and father of John Calvin, was saying the same thing at the same time independently and using the same words. So the phrase rule of Christ was established before the Reformation. It may have come from some monastic tradition. You know, in a monastic tradition, you have the rule of Benedict, the rule of Francis, the rule of Dominique, which explain a particular way that a particular school of monasteries organize their life. Maybe it was like that. Maybe it was alluding to or parallel to that. Maybe it was something a little more modest. Just Jesus said, do it, we'll call it the rule of Christ. It was also an important term in the Swiss Zwinglian Reformation, from which the so-called Anabaptist movement came, and they continued to practice it and to use the term. So Bucer, the Anabaptists, and Luther, independently of one another, all used the phrase rule of Christ as a practice that would obtain if we had a real church, according to the gospel, in the 16th century. Not only as the way to be pastors to the particular people that need that kind of reprimand, fraternal correction was another term they used for it, but also as a way to carry out the Reformation. And this we don't think about very often, because most of the people who carried out the Reformation had the government on their side. Martin Luther had his prince, and at a certain point, the prince would say, okay, you can print that book now. You can send visitors out to that parish and tell them that their pastor is defrocked if he won't celebrate the way you say he should. And in Switzerland, the same thing happened, except it was city-state governments rather than princes. But how would you reform the church if you didn't have a state behind you? Well, you just have to talk to people. So the people that later came to be called Anabaptists were saying already in 1524 that the way to reform the church is the rule of Christ. That is, you just figure out at what point should we still be doing this? Should we still be baptizing babies? Should we still be blessing the civil sword, the death penalty, and the preparation for war? Should we continue to recite the law the way we do, recite the Psalms the way we do? And one by one, you talk about it. You use the rule of Christ in its mode of discernment, and you'll decide what to change. And lo and behold, you'll come up with a free evangelical form of the church without needing a government to tell you when you have the right to start. And that's what the Anabaptists finally did. Although they didn't record the details through which their argument went, that's what they said they believed ought to be done and could be done. Now, in a non-voluntary community, like some of the Calvinists later, for instance, in the Netherlands, where Calvinism became the official religion of the whole culture, or the Puritans in Massachusetts, where Puritan Congregationalism was the religion of the whole culture, if the preachers do what Matthew 18 says and nobody else does, this can become a very oppressive cultural structure. And then people can say they don't want it anymore. It's not loving. It's not reconciling. It reinforces the power structure of the few. The same is true in the Roman Catholic setting, where, after centuries, this is linked with the sacrament of penance and absolution, so that only a priest can do it. Because only a priest can forgive, can speak forgiveness. That's a point at which Luther was still much broader. Luther believed that anybody can speak forgiveness to the brother or sister. So combining Protestant dislike for the centering of this authority in a priest and the post-Puritan dislike for centering of this kind of authority in the hands of a pastor, we come down to the 19th and 20th century with the idea that the church has no business telling anybody anything. Because we see this as the church. Offices. Yeah, the officers of the church enforcing their will. But it isn't about that. It's about the brothers and sisters talking to each other. With the only place that the clerical authority of the church belong, maybe in the third stage, when it becomes the business of the ecclesia, the gathered total body. And that's probably the third phase is probably the one that's the least likely to help the person change their mind.
I came in a little bit late, but are you saying that the power to bind and loose is in the hands of the whole Christian community, not just the pastor or the priest?
This text has no reference to pastors and priests.
Because I've been wrong, and I've been teaching my people in this, that not so I have a feeling of power, but I've been saying this is one thing that is handed down through the ordained clergy, is the power to bind and to loose that we have.
I would certainly hope that those people who have the various leadership roles in the community would not be less disposed or less qualified to do this than anybody else.
Yeah, I would think so too.
But that's not my point. Is that it's not a monopoly. That this process begins with whoever knows about the offense, whether they be the one offended or somebody else. And the second stage involves two or three people who might sometimes appropriately be the wise elders, the leaders of the community, but they wouldn't have to be. They could be just the people that are most accessible, or the most aware, and the most likely to be listened to. It's only at the point that the whole congregation becomes involved that obviously then the formal leadership of the whole congregation is involved.
What about Matthew 16 and the keys given to Peter? Isn't that where the understanding in the...
Yeah, I think it's a coinciding of the Matthew 18 passage and the Matthew 16 passage that make it seem self-evident later that if the priestly leadership claims to monopolize this, we can let them do it. But there's no reference to special qualities at all in the Matthew in Matthew 18 text. The Luke 17 text has no reference to authorities. The John text, obviously, it is the apostles who are there in the upper room who receive the Spirit. So once we have the notion of special offices, then a kind of telescoping of this office, of this function, this activity, with the office of local leadership is not surprising. But the time that theme will most appropriately be dealt with will be when I come around to the theme of the ministries, where I'll also be representing something that's different from the Lutheran tradition.
I just wanted to say, and this might not be the appropriate time to bring this up, I'm a layperson in the Lutheran Church, and I have just gone through some very exciting training to become a mediator in conflict situations. I will be an informal representative of the bishop of my synod, and will go out into a congregation that is experiencing conflict and has hopefully tried to go through the first steps of Matthew 18. And then when that does not work, then I come in with a team of three lay people and three clergy, and we go through this mediation process.
Now, where did that idea come from?
That came from our bishop, Bishop Keller, who is the bishop of, I forget what we're called, but it's Eastern Washington and part of Idaho.
Well, where did he get the idea?
And where did he get it? From, I think, the Albion Institute is where he received his training to do this. And I had the privilege of serving on one of the Shalom teams, and that is why I was asked to become a mediator. And it's really exciting.
Well, again, you're getting relevant before I wanted to.
I'm sorry.
Let's look at the other question, and then I'll move on.
It gets more complicated when the definition of the two sacraments always includes the forgiveness of sins, and then the clergy are entrusted with the administration of the sacraments.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. The correlation of this activity with central priestly office is much more obvious when you focus on that central office bearer as the one who does the other things that you do that are sacramental. That's why I want to discuss it as a larger question of what offices are for as a different chapter. But the thing I wanted to come to next is precisely the leaping over the categories. We see early Christians were told by Jesus to do this. They were told, when you do it, God is doing it. In two dramatic ways, that is said. When you do it, I'm with you. And when you, what you do sends done in heaven. Well, that's the ordinary word for a sacrament. When it's something that people do that God is doing, when people do it right. Although most traditions don't call it a sacrament, there are some Baptists who call it an ordinance, and there was a time when Calvin or Bucer would have called it one of the orders that we ought to do. But it has that quality. Then we saw very spasmodically that in the origins of Protestantism, it was supposed to have a formative and a reforming role. It didn't quite bear the fruit it could have, but it was noticed by the leading Reformed thinkers as something that ought to happen, as a part of the reformation of the church. And now to move to the modern church, or even beyond the modern church, to the modern society, conflict resolution has now become a social science. You can take courses in psychology, in sociology, in anthropology. You can get professional accreditation. You can get jobs with the government, or we just heard you can get a job with the church, because there are skills in helping this thing to happen. Just didn't say you needed any skills, but it is a complicated process, and it has a lot to do with the psychological background of the people and their hang-ups and their education. So there are better and worse ways to facilitate this happening. There is a federal agency called the Community Reconciliation Service, which, as far back as Martin Luther King, put staff people in hotspots in order to facilitate communication between warring parties in their race relations clashes. One of the men who were with the King process at the time, way back in 63, 68, is now the person who designed the National Peace Academy, which is a new federal institution. It happened that Ronald Reagan packed its board with rightists, so it won't do much for a while, but the concept was that it would be an agency to project even beyond domestic clash the insights of conflict resolution as a social science and a social skill. So there are ways to splash over beyond the membership of the Christian community the intention of binding and loosening, that is, of reconciling and discerning moral decision-making processes being dialogical. What do they carry over from the rule of Christ? You begin at the point of offense, and the offense is concretized in the person offended. You don't try to depersonalize it, but reaching way back for a law or for a category that the sin belongs in. You identify who cares why, who was hurt how. The intention is correction or reconciliation, not punishment, not revenge, not teaching some third party a lesson, not restoring somebody's face or prestige, although that often is a part of the sensitivity that the expert has as to how to go about it. The frame of reference is some kind of value commonality of the parties. In the Christian community, that's obvious what your value commonality is supposed to be. In the wider society, at least both the blacks and the Hispanics want to have good hospital service in this neighborhood. And the whites that are left. That is, the various parties that are in a clash have some common humanity. They don't want permanent war. And if you could show them a way to get past the polarization that they are stuck in, there would be a way forward that both of them would be served by. The first efforts are made so as to minimize publicity and minimize open threat. And the only ultimate sanction is not prosecution, but that there it comes to be known publicly that these people ought to be ashamed of themselves. And for that, we have the media. That has been now for 20 years in a very small form a social skill, a social science, and a profession. And there is an annual meeting of professionals in this field that gathers a couple thousand people in Chicago once a year to talk about all the little subcategories in which you can develop skill in doing this well. Another example is one that just happened to arise in our part of Indiana. Well, now it has created a model that's also being used elsewhere, I believe. Somebody was starting it in Seattle, called Victim-Offender Reconciliation Program, so they call it VORP. If possible before prosecution, or sometimes even after, sometimes under order of the court, special mediators get the person who committed a burglary together with the little old lady who was burgled. They make the offender see in the flesh who was hurt, and who was frightened. And normally, the offender and the victim don't get together. The ordinary court system tries to keep them apart. And nobody cares really about the victim's restoration as a part of the business of either the prosecutor or the defense. It's the neighborhood, people are aghast, people say, isn't it too bad? And if there's some special tragedy, then some newspaper will collect some money for something. But normally there is no structure that cares about the victim. If the people who care about the victim also care about the offender and focus on whether they could be brought to meet each other face to face, there are very wholesome resolutions that can be brought about, not all the time, but some of the time, which has an effect on the jail population and on the ability of the local courts to be credible and many other things.
Has that been able to work with sex crimes?
I haven't heard of it. What I've heard about that works the most dramatically is minor burglaries.
Crimes against property, but not crimes against people.
Well, if you were a little lady, you would think that burglary was a crime against your person.
Well, generally those are the...
Yeah.
The one an interesting case is the family, a young man had raped and murdered the daughter of a family, and that family took the offender in, said to the courts, we will be responsible for this person's rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, I heard of it once, we clipped it from the newspaper, we put it in our files because I didn't expect to hear of it again.
I've heard of it in relation to murder, but not with regard to sex offenses.
Well, this was a rape and a murder, so, but it was the family of the victim, who were victims too, who said, and it was out of their Christian faith, we can't replace our daughter, but maybe we can save this young man's life.
Huh. I've seen panels on television where they had, that was the part of the therapy, the rapists and the victims were there together, and they dealt with the problems together. And they're trying to restore the sex offenders to a more normal life.
Well, some of the people that I know in this VORP network wish they had the confidence and the moral authority to deal with rape and other sex abuse cases. But thus far, the places that the courts and the local prosecutors have given them freedom to work have more been minor property offenses.
There are some therapy programs for sex abusers, if it's like a father and a daughter, it's in family, where it has to be worked out together and that step closer to home. And
so the structural point that I think this material makes is that our wanting to keep the categories clean between something that we call a rule of ethics and something else that we call a sacrament and something else that we think is an interesting first century practice and something else that's politically relevant often don't help us as much as expecting realities to have the same shape across those columns, and that something about the gospel will be more transportable if we state it in the first century and in the 20th century in terms of human practices and not the theories about what happens to the bread or whether people are now going to heaven or not. Thank you.
question about this practice, though. To go to the one who has offended you, for me to go to the one who has offended me, and to really will and desire reconciliation and restoration of relationship means a lot of work on my own first, like laying down my desire for retribution or my desire to remain wounded a while longer, or my desire for the pity of other people, or wonder if there isn't even a step before that, or a sacramental work that happens before that, where the victim is can really will the good for the offender.
Well, if you aren't ready to want the restoration of the offender, it's the whole gospel you need. It isn't just a pointer about due process.
That's right.
And that's the way Jesus put it in the rest of Matthew 18. I mean, he has the other parallels. The person to whom much was forgiven who didn't forgive a little. And Peter's asking, well, is seven enough? And he says, no, 70 times seven. And that doesn't mean that I have a little notebook with 490 squares on each sheet for each of my friends. And when they get to 491, I've got it means just infinitely. So the point of the whole chapter of Matthew 18 is an infinite disposition to take this initiative. And if we don't have that infinite disposition, then something else isn't clicking in the way we're hearing the gospel.
Concerning this church discipline, our church constitution has it in there, church discipline, according to Matthew 18. And I would expect that probably all church constitutions have it in there. But who reads the church constitution and goes by? And it's rather sad that it is that way, because why have something that you aren't going by?
Well, that would be a very interesting historical study. Is it really in all the constitutions, or did it get in somewhere because of some particular renewal insight of some person? And then it would be fascinating to know where that came from, which generation.
But there's some question, in my mind at least, and as a parish pastor, with some experience with this, how effectively that little article, which is, I think, in most of our constitutions, functions as a law, as opposed to an expression of the spirit of reconciliation in the congregation, which is what we'd like to have. It's, I think it's a very hard thing. I think it's very difficult to use this as a law. Then it becomes another hammer. You have to do it this way.
It's not intended as law. It's supposed to be admonishment of love.
But if I were understanding it from outside, not knowing the Lutheran doctrine of constitutions, I would see that the constitutional text is rather just an authorization for it to happen out of grace. So that if my brother comes to me, I have no right to say, what do you think you're doing? Because it says in the text of the statutes of the organization I committed myself to that that's part of what I want. So that it would be authorization, but it wouldn't be that the person comes to me because it's in the Constitution. The person comes to me because she loves me.
Reconciliation is sometimes a last resort in a congregation, that's what I'm saying. That gee, things have gotten to this awful state, now we'll do
But sometimes offense is not personal against any individual. Sometimes it's an offense in the congregation, and it must be dealt with.
Well, that's one of the things. I'm not sure whether you were already here when I mentioned the actual text in Matthew varies in different manuscripts. Sometimes it is said against you, and then people take that to mean it's not my business to be responsible for this brother's offense because I'm not the one that hurts. Or maybe it was only against me and I can stand it because I'm a big person or I'm thick-skinned. Where the concern is for the restoration of the offender, and therefore, if it's a victimless offense, or if it's an offense just against the mores of the society, and no particular individual is hurt, we still care about that person's restoration. And so, you're right, it means that there's no clear focus of whose business it is. And that raises another problem, which I suspect the pastors among us would think of too. What if somebody's a pathological busybody and is going around reprimanding everybody for everything? That is a possible. That is a possible abuse. But the thing to do about that is to reprimand that person. I guess I should say him. Because that too is an offense. Because that's not what the passage is about. The passage is about dealing reconcilingly with authentic offenses to the point that they don't matter anymore.
Well, the goal is to bring about confession and forgiveness. You know, sometimes, well, it's kind of hard to explain, but sometimes people, the offense is that they don't believe it is a sin. And in Scripture, if it goes against Scripture, and it's scripturally, you can say this is a sin. And a person can't, if you don't believe something is a sin, you can't ask for forgiveness of it, because if you don't believe it is a sin. And yet, if it is causing dissension in a congregation, then it must be dealt with. So how else are you going to handle it if you don't go to Matthew 18? You have to use the Scripture and bring about reconciliation in a manner that is acceptable according to Scripture, not according to what I think or what I believe. And what I think is wrong and somebody else would think is right and that sort of thing, because we all have opinions, and opinions aren't really what you can depend upon.
That is an important new paragraph in the discussion that hasn't been dealt with when we're talking on the basis of basic norms. I think it was assumed in the church that Matthew was writing for that everybody knew pretty well what would be covered by the category of sin. And there wasn't the very broad, pluralistic cultural setting in which now we can think of people who differ on almost any question as to the details of right and wrong in certain settings. Does that mean the whole thing falls apart, or is there some way to adjust this style to the fact of different opinions about right and wrong in certain matters? I think I'd rather say we would be called to do the latter. If I think what you're doing is wrong, I owe it to you to make that visible to you, make it understandable to you in a loving, reconciling spirit. You may change my mind. And then that will certainly have been worthwhile, because I was holding to an invalid judgment on some matter. And it's only by taking you seriously, thinking that you were the offender, that I discover I was the offender. And the tables are turned, and I have to apologize for being judgmental. And the position of the community has changed through my adjusting to the fact that what you were doing is not sinful after all. That's maximum change on one end. The other end, it might be that if you talk with the person who was offended profoundly enough, caringly enough, carefully enough, they will see how it hurt, even though they won't see that when they did it, they were breaking a rule they knew about. And that will also be the wherewithal for some kind of reconciliation. Even an agreement to disagree would be a step forward from not having talked about it, and would, in some cases, be a reconciling solution for the short run for a community in which you have to tolerate difference on this particular matter because it isn't something on which you can have an easily sliced answer. So the process would seem to be capable of adjusting to the situation where we don't agree on what is sin. We still ought to do it.
Well, in the beginning you were talking about binding and loosing according to Scripture. And I don't know how many people use the catechism anymore. That seems to be something we don't even bring up anymore, the catechism. But I learned from the catechism, and I still refer to it. In the catechism, we talk about the office of the keys, which is just what you were talking about. I don't hear that term used anymore, and I don't know why not. Now, when we talk about the congregation or the layperson forgiving sins, or a binding or loosing. They do have that responsibility, but as a congregation, we have chosen to call him a pastor, that we do it through a pastor in confession and in our communion. He forgives sins. And that is the way that we do it as a congregation, rather than going around individually talking to each other, which is certainly permissible and encouraged. My big concern right now is through the ALC, and now it becomes the ELCA, is that we no longer have confession before communion. And I would have been explained to me that, okay, communion is a celebration. Yes, it is. A celebration that Christ has forgiven me my sins. And I don't want to forget first to confess my sins, which I should do daily through the renewal of my baptism. But I still think that it was a wonderful practice when I came to communion to public and confess with my brothers and sisters in Christ a confession and receive the absolution before I receive communion. Then I have real celebration, and I'm real unhappy about that being dropped. And I just, why has it been dropped?
Can anybody explain what has happened in the? Did the three merging groups have different practices in the past? Didn't they all have an absolution in the order?
It's still in the order.
It's in the book, but
it's
we
still
don't
in the
it.
Order. It's in.
Individual pastor.
That's a matter of your pastor or your congregation deciding not to use it.
It is still
it's
in the book.
There.
Yeah.
It's still there.
Yeah.
In fact, there are five forms of confession and absolution in the book. Five different forms.
Well, if there's five, it's probably easier just to use none of them then, I guess.
But do other churches use it, or is it just
yes?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've been complaining for 7 years, and I haven't done, you know.
Well, you should take two or three people along.
My main concern in the process, just practically, is in the modern church, many of us are quite large, and we have between 400 and 500 members in our church, and families, excuse me, and it gets down into a practical sense. I feel comfortable going to someone with a concern. But in a large suburban area where you don't know everyone in your church, and I'm active, I was a president of the congregation, sing in the choir, teach Sunday school, I've done everything in the church, and I'm as, you know, and I know about as many as anyone, still there's a sense of fragmentation. So it has to be a most blatant kind of a thing happening, situation happening, for anyone to know. And so so we have small groups in our church, probably 40 or 50 small groups, which help compensate for the largest of our church. But still, I have a sense that that's a very important process, but in a practical sense, in a large church, it is doesn't work.
Well, with people going off to Narnia, I think maybe if we started 5 minutes earlier than we used to, we should also close pretty soon. If we believe that this process is important to the life of the church, then we'll find ways to structure the life of the church so that this process will be more normal. And small groups are certainly one way to do it. That is, to consider the hundreds of people who gather on Sunday morning for a liturgical celebration to be a federation of 20 house churches, people who know each other through the week enough that it would be natural for this kind of mutual accountability to take place on that in a smaller scale. The thing that does kill it, I think, is if it gets to be seen as punitive or as a law in the sense that it just always has to happen, that then leads you to distinguish between big sins and little sins.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've distinguished between big sins and little sins, you're playing a different game. It's a different operation going on.
Who says there's big sins and little sins?
Anybody who has a large organization and can't crank up the machinery for every case moves that way. But obviously, Jesus wasn't talking about big sins and little sins. He was talking about any offense.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you.